Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello, Greenhorns. This is Severin. This is Greenhorns Radio, radio for young farmers, by young farmers, exploring the issues of relevance to young farmers starting new businesses in the new economy, despite the old. And today I'm really thrilled to introduce Michael Schumann, who is an economist, attorney, author, entrepreneur. He's been institution maker for many years, writing and designing institutions to support the growth of a local economy. And he's here today to talk with us about some of the instruments and approaches to take as we seek to capitalize our new beginning local businesses in the context of a global economy that misunderstands and undervalues us. Thank you, Michael, for joining.
Great to be with you.
So, as I'm mentioning, this is a community that you're speaking to as a young farmer community, and I thought maybe it would be good to just introduce a little bit the work that you've been pursuing lately and how it is of relevance to us.
Sure. Well, the last book that I published, which was 2 years ago, called Local Dollars, Local Cents, was all about an emerging local investment revolution, which I see as sort of working hand-in-hand with the local food revolution. And one of the reasons why I wrote the book is that after, you know, earlier pieces of work that I did with local economies and go around the country and speak with many, many groups, the consistent feedback that I got was, you know, we know how to create local enterprise. We know where it belongs. You know, we can move very far, but we don't have the money to implement these businesses. We don't have the capital. And I became very interested in what were the ways that people, you know, in communities were beginning to crack down the walls that separated good local businesses from capital. So that's, I guess, one thing that I've been doing that very much ties in with the needs of young farmers, because I think at the end of the day, young farmers need ways of accessing land and accessing equipment and accessing various streams of money in order to, you know, front end invest on certain things before they can bring their crops to market. So there's a lot of concern, I think, that people in sort of the local food movement have about how we can really bring a lot more capital to bear.
So far we're in. I mean, this is exactly what's needed. So many of my colleagues in the Young Farmers Movement are struggling to figure out how to interact with local banks and with slow money investors and others who are interested to put capital towards $50,000, you know, for a barn or a processing facility or a kitchen or a shed or a kitchen or a sales area or packaging, all those kinds of things, and struggling to invent that and negotiate that while also running a business.
Right.
What are some tools that you have been working on?
Well, I think the most fundamental shift that we all need to make in our thinking is who we turn to for investment. And it's useful to pause for a second and sort of just describe the lay of the land legally, because back in the 1930s, the United States implemented, as did a bunch of other countries, a system of laws called securities laws. And I call these laws investment apartheid, because they really set up a kind of a two-class system. If you're very wealthy, literally in the top 1% of wealth holders or income earners, you're allowed to invest in anybody, anytime, no questions asked. If you're in the other 99%, you may only invest a penny in a local business or a farm if that business has done an enormous amount of legal work, which could easily cost $25,000, $50,000, $100,000, and very few businesses ever want to do that. So to kind of go back to where you started from, which is, all right, so let's say I am a newcomer farmer. I want to either put down some money to buy a farm or to lease a farm. Where am I going to get that money from? Well, if it's a big chunk of money, maybe I'll turn to a bank. But a bank, you know, banks are very, very conservative animals. They often do not lend to young people without a lot of credit history. And if you were borrowing that money, say, to advance on payments on, inputs into production, seeds and the like, that would be sort of working capital, and they would not want you to put money into working capital because that is too risky. So banks often are not a good place to go. So where you might go instead would be the 1%, the accredited investor. And it is true that there is a tiny, tiny number of accredited investors who are interested in this. And thank goodness for Woody Tash and Slow Money creating a movement of accredited investors largely who are interested in supporting local food businesses and you know, early stage farmers. And so there's a little bit more of that than there was before. But at the end of the day, the most important source of funding for us to turn to is friends, neighbors, contacts, fans, and almost all these people are going to be unaccredited. So thinking about ways that we can, in a sense, crowdfund, and crowdfund has many different meanings, but I'll just mean it in the sort of abstract sense of many people putting small amounts of money in. But I think crowdfunding our farms, crowdfunding equipment, and in a way CSAs have done this for years. I mean, CSAs are a form of people crowdfunding through pre-purchasing via a subscription of baskets of food. And we just need to sort of build on those concepts.
This is really interesting to me because I'm actually sitting here in a co-working space in Oakland with a little phone booth, and we are having our first strategy session with the Sustainable Economies Law Center, who I know is a partner in the Cutting Edge Capital community investment model that you were working on. And we're talking about agrarian trust, and we're talking about community ownership of land in a broader sense than just community ownership over one particular farm, but of creating a farmland commons, which is kind of like group-owned by a big pool of investors or land gifters or bequests. And that essentially you'd have land which is owned by many people and an investment mechanism which would take the money of those many people and administrate and oversee governance of that land, which would then no longer be bought and sold every generation, incurring all the taxation problems and drama of those intergenerational transfers. So this is very germane to the project that I'm super focused on right now, and I wonder if you could, just listening to that dilemma, offer some general principles of how to conceptualize and make that form live.
Right. So a couple of different things to say. So first of all, I think the general concept here of getting a lot of people to invest in a parcel of land and thereby lowering the threshold that otherwise would stand in the way of a of a farmer setting up and doing business absolutely needs to be done. And we should be putting more and more of our land in community control, because at the end of the day, that's the best way of protecting farmland, the best way of protecting green spaces. Even if you're interested in downtown development, getting a community to invest in downtown parcels of land helps to control, you know, to keep chain stores out and you know, the kinds of developments that one wants in their downtown in. So ownership is really quite critical. The second thing I would say is that there are many, many different kinds of legal vehicles that one could use for this. So a trust or a land trust, you could create a partnership, you could create a kind of mass stock company that is owned by a lot of different people, you could put it in the form of a traditional nonprofit, you could create a co-op where the co-op owns, every member of the co-op owns a small piece of the land. And so the choice that you make for the legal structure will depend a lot on, you know, well, what are the interests of the people in the group? What kind of decision-making authority do they want? What's their need, if any, for a rate of return from their investment? So those are all good, easy problems to work through. But it's just, you know, good to remind ourselves that many, many options exist. And just to kind of give one interesting option, in Minnesota, there's something called the Northeast Housing Cooperative, Investment Cooperative, which basically has created a co-op that allows co-op members to invest in low-income housing for other members of the co-op. And it's a very creative use of the co-op structure, which formerly might only have been done through, say, a land trust. So the third thing that I would say about this is that, you know, however one proceeds, it's really useful to kind of figure out a low-dollar, easy way of fulfilling the securities laws requirement that I talked about a few minutes ago. And, you know, really there's sort of three pathways to doing this right now, all of which are useful to talk about. So the first pathway is that, you know, for years and years, it has been possible within any state in the United States to spend the $25,000, say, on legal fees and create a stock issue or some other ownership scheme, could be within a co-op, so that lots of people can invest. And this is called a direct public offering, because the company that does this legal work is offering shares directly to the public, and then unaccredited investors can buy into it. And so these direct public offerings are becoming more and more common around the United States, but they're still kind of expensive, you know, $25,000 to do one. The next thing, the next option is what's called the Jobs Act. So 2 years ago, Congress passed and then President Obama signed a law that created a kind of streamlined process for federal crowdfunding, where anyone could go to a website and anyone could put up to $2,000 per company per year in, and the legal work involved in this would be very limited. Now, the problem with the Jobs Act is that the Securities and Exchange Commission has to actually implement some regulations before this law can be used. They were supposed to have completed their homework by December of 2012, and here we are 2 years later, and they still haven't done it with no end in sight. So it's unclear what's happening with the Jobs Act. The third route, and this may be the most important route, is that states, really angry that the federal government did not implement the Jobs Act, have created their own state Jobs Act. And more than a dozen states In some progressive states like Oregon and Washington, and some conservative states like Georgia and Alabama, have implemented these mini jobs acts that make it, you know, really cheap and easy to do funding locally within the state of, you know, any given kind of company. So I think that for many of your listeners, this third approach may well be the ticket to how they are able to bring, you know, many small contributors into, you know, whatever this farming entity is, whether it's a co-op, nonprofit, land trust, et cetera.
Well, in France, which is where we found the model for agrarian trust, which is a group called Terre de Lien, which is actually a foundation that works in partnership with an investment vehicle that works in conjunction with a nonprofit. So it's like a space station of different organizational forms that are contracted into each other, and they managed to get most of their investment because the federal government in France had created a kind of a community bond or an incentive for savings for individual investors to get a little tax benefit for participating in, you know, public interest vehicles for investment.
Yes.
And again, that's a socialist country that's working to incent certain behaviors. Savings is not something that I don't think that the U.S. government is as focused on people saving as they are in France. Maybe you could reflect on what's different here in the U.S. or what we could learn from that.
Well, we certainly can learn from that, and I would say even closer to home, a number of the provinces in Canada very creatively use tax credits in order to support local investing. And I'll give you two examples. In the province of Manitoba, any investment in a qualified locally owned business will get you a 30% tax credit from the province. So in other words, for every dollar you invest, you get 30 cents off of your provincial taxes. And in the province of Nova Scotia in 1998, they created a law that makes it very easy for groups of grassroots folks to create their own investment pools where they might put together, say, multiple loans to local businesses. And they also created a tax credit so that, I think it's also about 30%, to encourage people to put money into these funds. And just, fast forward 16 years later, Nova Scotia has 50 of these funds. Most of them are focused on new farms or local food businesses. And if the United States had as many of these funds per capita as Nova Scotia does, we would have 17,000 of them. So to me, it kind of underscores that this tax credit is a very, very powerful tool. Now, in the United States, we have all kinds of tax credits in both the federal and state level, but these credits largely are built around old-style economic development, which almost everyone acknowledges is a complete failure. And, for example, I'm trying to remember the state. I was recently in Louisiana, and discovered that they have a 30 or 35% tax credit for angel investors who put money in certain kinds of local business. In other words, the tax credit is only available to the 1% that is accredited investors, and no one else can use it. So, you know, that's an example of a kind of law that we have to tweak and reform so that the other 99% of us can take advantage of this as well. And once that's in place, then it'll be a lot easier to bring people into, you know, these kinds of farm farm enterprise vehicles that we're talking about?
Well, it's funny. There's another interesting investment incentive for Chinese citizens who are seeking residency in the United States if they invest, I think it's $200,000 or $300,000 into a new business in the United States, and they can get citizenship. And a friend, I heard about it because a friend of mine got this amazing investment for her ginseng farm from a Chinese investor syndicate. So that's besides the point, but slightly scary.
So what
did it take in order to set the framework? We just had a really great lecture on Friday, which is going out on a video next week, from Eric Freifogel, who's been studying case law and natural resource law for 35 years, and he's a professor of law in Illinois. And he was suggesting that having a statutory approach to use rights for land would be a very wise course of action, and an acknowledgement that local food security and community food security is a public good, and that the use of land for that good, supports the land use that we are trying to push our aim towards. And the same way that the health community is often talking about, we need a health bill or a food bill instead of a farm bill, in order to align our kind of federal policy priorities with human health instead of with the lobby groups who have established themselves to eat off the common pool. And I wonder if you could give a little guidance about whether that would be a useful tool to set a kind of a land use goal in that way.
I think it would be useful. I think it's always helpful when public policy makes some pronouncements that says that, you know, these are favored uses of land or favored uses of property. But, of course, you want special treatment to be accorded to them if they are favored. And so that special treatment could be a tax credit, or it could be some other kind of benefit, like maybe these enterprises have, you know, get lower tax rates generally, or they get, specialty access to certain kinds of business support programs. So we want to make sure that these things have teeth on top of it. And I think, you know, framing it as food businesses rather than farm businesses is very sensible, because what we've wound up with in, you know, every farm bill, you know, in recent memory, is that these bills are entirely about protecting big farmers, big agri, rather than, you know, supporting family farmers and local food. And so a reframing is definitely in order. But I would also say that there is a lot that one can do with no legal changes at all. And that's why I pointed out that, you know, using these other available tools to kind of create either a direct public offering, within a state using the old exemption or using one of these new laws is creating, you know, interesting pathways for groups of businesses to raise money for themselves from unaccredited investors, and we should really support that.
Then you laid out this list of tools in your writings, and you also send it along to me. And are we allowed to blog that?
Absolutely. Yes. Okay, that's a list of 24 local investment tools that I both write about in Local Dollars, Local Sense, and have been sort of looking at ever since. And it's everything from, you know, how to work with your local bank and credit union, and how to perhaps create a co-op in support of your business, how to set up land trusts, how to set up investment funds, how to create a local stock market, how to think about your own personal finances as a way of localizing your investment. So, yeah, there's a lot of different tools on there, and I'd be happy for you to post it, or happy to send it to anyone who contacts me.
Well, I really appreciate that. You know, it's funny how a generation of people who are building their own greenhouses and loading docks and restoring barns and reclaiming fields from forests and, you know, really inventing every aspect of that new farm enterprise, when we get to the financial instruments and the legal instruments and the investment instruments, it's nice to see that there are many people who are inventing new instruments and adapting existing ones so that we can kind of hack together the tools that fit in our particular case. And I think emboldening this community of young farmers to take the time over winter, which is now, to learn about and research and talk on the phone with folks who are featured in your book and whose work has, you know, is increasingly documented online, to poke holes at and problem solve and kind of case out the viability of those options for your business.
Yeah, well,
just in the last minute, where do you suggest that we use our winter research time, which is very limited, to educate ourselves and some guidance for that process?
Well, I would say, you know, what I would always ask is, what is the business out there that I wish existed that would make my business easier? So it may be a land trust, but it may be a meat processing company, or it may be a better transportation service to bring what I produce on the farm to restaurants or retailers or to homes, or it may be a better marketing device. But whatever those businesses are, think about ways that you could create that business working with other businesses and creating a co-op or some other partnership to make it happen. You know, I think there are, as much as I often argue that smaller businesses, smaller farms, you know, they are much more competitive than people think. But nevertheless, it does sometimes help to get a larger scale. And there is no scale that a small local business cannot achieve if they get together with other similar businesses and collaborate. So there's a lot of power, I think, in what you're doing and the people that you speak to are doing in bringing farmers and other small food businesses together to work together and create these new companies.
I agree. And there's so much value in the institution making as well. And, you know, sometimes people come into the young farmer world and they think they want to be a farmer and they learn about farming and then they decide, well, maybe not. I'm actually more inclined to do other tasks. And this is a perfect task for them.
Yes.
It's definitely a perfect task for me. So, well, I hope I really thank you for joining us. This is the end of our time, and I am aware that there's many more questions that I would love to ask, and I wonder if you'd be willing to look over our shoulder as we are working on GitHub, which is an open source platform usually used for creating code in an open source way. Well, we're using that GitHub as a platform for creating the legal structure of the agrarian trust.
That's great. No, happy to help in any way I can, and let's definitely have some conversations in the future.
Thank you, sir, and thank you to all of you. I want to remind everyone listening of the incredible series of events that are coming up. Obviously, Thanksgiving is on Thursday. And then we have our tour, GrangeFuture.net, is a community history exhibit celebrating the history and revival of the Grange idea. The Grange, as you know, is a fraternal organization from 1867 that became a social as well as political platform for farmers coping with the monopoly structures of the railroads and the grain consolidation. The Grange lives on. It is America's oldest agricultural organization. And we, Greenhorns, are bringing an exhibit about the history of the Grange with oral histories from 8 different regions of the United States, starting up in northern Mendocino County and all the way down to San Diego County, as we do our first leg of this Grange Future Tour. Also, next weekend is December 7th. Oh, Grumble, what is it? December 5th is Farmhack Mendocino, with a focus on fuel ethanol made from the waste material of the wine grape. Come and learn at the Ridgewood Ranch. More information at farmhack.net. Okay, look forward to talking to everyone next week. So much coming on. Have a great winter. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.